Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
Meat and Three is Heritage Radio Network's weekly food news roundup. This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you highlights from Feast Portland, like our chat with the one and only Andrew Zimmern.
I'm super excited to be here because for people who do what I do for a living, we do tons of, you know, desk side chats and podcasts and interviews and stuff like that. And you circle the handful of ones in a year where you get to talk with people that you're really excited about talking with. So this is awesome.
We picked up on some recurring themes while talking to our impressive roster of guests, including the current state of Portland's food scene, personal identity, and believe it or not, the influence of great chefs' grandmothers.
Meemaw never touched a drop of booze in her life and now has a distillery named after her. But I grew up in her garden and just really, she taught me all good things come from scratch and women can be anyone they want to be.
So tune in for this week's extra special episode. Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Bobardus in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my co-guest. And my guest today is Elizabeth Sandow, who already joined us 5 times on episode 18, 61, 83, 99, and 108, and shared her truly deep insight into traditional Japanese food culture. Elizabeth is a food writer and a Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo, and she has lived in Japan for over 50 years now. So she runs a culinary arts program called A Taste of Culture, which offers a great opportunity for non-Japanese people to explore Japanese culture through its food. So you should check it out if you have a plan to go to Japan. And Elizabeth is also the author of 6 cookbooks, including the award-winning Washoku, Recipes from Japanese Kitchen, published in 2005. And today's topic is dashi. Dashi is no doubt the foundation of Japanese cuisine, but many of us don't know what exactly it is and how to make it and how it is used. So we'll discuss all about them. And before we start, Japanese is available on the Heritage Radio Network website as well as on iTunes and Stitcher as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify and subscribe to Japanese. And please write a review. We are on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. We appreciate your feedback. And I have an announcement. So on Wednesday, October 10th, there will be a special event called the New York Chefs Celebrate Japan. So it's a benefit for the Gohan Society. The Gohan Society is a 501c3 nonprofit organization which aims to foster an understanding of Japanese culinary heritage in the United States through various meaningful activities, including American Chefs Training Program in Japan. And at this special event, 27 chefs from New York City's best restaurants will cook dinner for you, including Gramercy Tavern, Daniel Nobu Morimoto Boulay at Home, and Contra, and so on. So, and the culinary expert and television personality Andrew Zimmern will be in attendance and auctioning off an amazing prize, which is a dinner for 14 prepared by Andrew himself, Chef Michael Anthony of Gramercy Tavern and Untitled, and Chef Gavin Kaisen, formerly at the Daniel Boulud, the Boulud, the Cafe Boulud of Minneapolis, now restaurant Spoon and Stable in the winner's home. So for tickets, please go to www.gohansociety.org and gohansociety.org. Now let's start our conversation with Elizabeth Sandow. Hello, welcome back.
Thank you, but it sounds like we'll be missing something wonderful. I wish I could stay a bit longer.
Well, maybe you should think about it.
Yeah, I wish I could.
Right. So Let's talk about dashi.
So, yes.
This is huge.
Huge, absolutely huge. And it's wonderful that you've given me this opportunity to sort of put together a lot of bits and pieces and try to make it a cohesive whole so that people really have a sense of what it's all about. I'd like to start with what the word means, dashi. Right. And it's interesting because when you first learn to read Japanese, it's a fairly simple character to read, but it's usually meant like going out or throwing out. Mm. And that's not what dashi is about. It's part of a verb, hikidasu, which means to extract. And it's really all about extracting flavor.
Mm.
And there are certain ingredients where that potential is much greater, and it's easier to do. But you could make dashi, theoretically, from almost anything.
Mm.
But it's all about extracting flavor into this liquid and then being able to use the liquid to its best advantage.
Mm. Right. So let's talk about where you extract the flavor from. So the ingredients.
Right.
So I think dashi ingredients in Japan is very unique and traditional. So maybe you can start with kombu.
Kombu is probably the one ingredient which would be really difficult to substitute for something else. There's a unique potential in that sort of strange-looking, if you've never seen it before, it looks like almost a dry piece of leather, and you wonder why anybody could get excited by it. There are many different varieties. And the Japanese, within Japan, the water sauce, people who are turn on water from the tap and the kind of water that they get, is quite different, soft to hard. And different kinds of kombu respond better to different kinds of water.
Mm.
So generally in the Tokyo area, in the Kanto Plain area, Hidaka kombu, and the name Hidaka is usually capital H because it's a place in Hokkaido and it's named after that, is usually the best kombu to use for harder water. And I would say New York water is very similar to that.
Mm.
So certainly people in the New York area or most East Coast locations, unless they're going to be using filtered water, Hidaka kombu is probably the kombu of choice. And
right.
It's a good thing because it's the most readily available.
Right. So, well, just as a basic kombu knowledge,
really?
I heard that 92% of kombu is produced in Hokkaido area because
right.
of, you know, the cold water and all those history of making it, as well as sun.
Right.
Yeah, it's made sun-dried and big.
Also the terroir. Well, terroir, the word really has to do with soil, so it doesn't work. It's all about the water. But the different mineral content of the water in different parts of Hokkaido.
Mm.
And quite different. So I would call a basic wardrobe of kombu, if you were going to get a basic wardrobe, so it could do lots of different things. Hidaka, definitely. And probably rishiri if you wanted to make a clear broth, because it crystal clear and almost a silky mouthfeel. So those very gorgeous clear broths where there's something sort of floating in the bottom of the bowl, they're typically made with rishiri kombu. It's tend to be more expensive, but it's definitely worth
right.
it.
So Ribbon and the Rishiri, those are two islands near, like, you know, part of Hokkaido.
Right.
Right.
But very much further north and closer to what is part of Russia.
Right.
So Rishiri is a very different mineral content, and the kombu, the kelp that grows there is quite different in flavor.
Mm. So just to add that, you know, the 90% made in Hokkaido and then used mainly, the kombu culture was developed in Kyoto and Osaka because even if it's very far away from the north, to bring it to Kyoto, there's what's called a kombu road.
Right.
And there's like a special, the kombu special ship, huge ship transporting from Hokkaido to Kyoto and Osaka. So it's a huge deal. And
it really is. And in Osaka for many years, almost 10 years, my husband and I lived a sort of a tale of two cities. We lived in both Osaka and in Tokyo at the same time. And I remember thinking how very different the food culture down in the Kansai, down in Osaka and Kyoto was. Mm. And indeed, the kombu is different. Down there, makombu is the sort of the default mode. And that's partly because the water in that region is so soft. And hidaka doesn't really yield much flavor in Osaka water.
Right. And, interesting. Because the minerality, how high it is in water is really interesting, because I heard Kyoto chefs go to France to cook at a cooking event, and they have to bring soft water.
They bring their own water. I know. It sounds a bit sort of over the top, but it really does make a difference.
Mm.
Usually you can approximate the softer water more easily using filtered water or bottled water.
Mm.
It's harder to go the other way. You can't add back the extra minerals.
Right.
It's easier to remove them.
Mm.
But the water does make a difference.
Right. So it sounds obsessive, but I think it really determines. If you try to make dashi by yourself in cold or soft water, the hard or soft water environment, you can really tell. Even I could tell.
I think most people, I do a lot of tasting programs, and most people can recognize the difference.
Mm.
They can't necessarily put a label on it. They can't say, that's dishiri I just tasted, or this is makombu.
Mm.
But they certainly know that they don't taste the same.
Right, yeah. So just to stress how kombu is important in Japanese culture, I had a research project in January, and I went to interview Kyoto chefs about kombu, and their eyes sparkle.
Lots of opinions, right?
Right. And also, they also visited the kombu, what they call top class kombu merchant called the Okui Kaisedo in Fukui Prefecture.
Right.
It's nearby Kyoto. And they age kombu. And Kyoto chefs prefer using 2 to 3 year aged kombu, which is more expensive, of course, that real estate and labor cost to age. But Japanese chefs are really obsessed with kombu.
It makes a difference. It really does. And hopefully everybody who's listening to this will have a chance to experience the ultimate, I would call in that. But no matter what kombu you have, the advice that I would give is that you first create a water extraction at room temperature, that you don't apply heat right away. And depending upon the kind of kombu, it's even more heat sensitive. Hidaka is fairly forgiving. I mean, if you were really in a rush and you forgot to soak it, and you put it in a pot and put it over the stove right away.
Because it has a softer fiber.
It does, and also because typically if the water is hard, it releases its minerals much more quickly in that water.
Right.
Whereas most of the other kinds of kombu that are very high glutamate, I mean, it's the glutamates in the kombu that create potential for intense flavor.
Right.
Really, the higher the rate of glutamate in the kombu, the more important it is to let it soak. And I would say for at least 10 minutes, 20 or 30 would be better. And I just suggest to people that they create a new kitchen habit. They wake up in the morning, they put a piece of kombu in a glass jar, glass so that it won't react with the water.
But you cannot do overnight?
You can do it overnight or before they go to bed, depending upon whether you're a morning person or a night person.
Right.
But 10 to 12 hours is a more reliable water extraction. And you don't even need to heat that. I mean, you can use it just as it is.
Mm-hmm.
And because dashi is often the hidden ingredient in a lot of foods, particularly in combination with eggs. So when you're making chawamushi, you need to have not hot dashi or it'll start to curdle the eggs right away.
Mm-hmm.
So having room temperature or cold dashi on hand is extremely useful.
Mm.
So it's just a new kitchen habit, not terribly difficult.
You
just have to remember to do it.
Right.
And you've got the potential to use all sorts of, to up the ante on the flavor of all sorts of things by just using kombu liquid, kombu jiru, instead of water.
Mm. Right. So, because kombu is made of almost spending 6 months to, the harvest and dry shape it.
Well, like with any dried ingredient, the flavor intensifies. It's concentrated as soon as it becomes dried. Right. And the aging process does it even more. Mm. If it's aged under the right conditions, cool, fairly dry temperatures, it increases masu-masu. Right. It becomes even more intense.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It's funny. One of the chefs I interviewed, he said in Kyoto, 2 years is good. And once you pass over 3 years, it gets too intensified. That does really interrupt the flavor of the ingredients to cook with.
Yes, it sort of overpowers them all. But that doesn't mean, folks, that you should use kombu and then just think if you leave it on your shelf for 10 years, it's going to be better.
Well, but you know, at the Okui Kaisedo, that top kombu merchant, right, there's a 29-year kombu.
Oh, my goodness.
And it's not for use or sale, but... Right. You know, it's just amazing how it can be cured by right condition. Right. And I was curious to taste it, but
that's called really delayed gratification. To have to wait that long. Some pickles you have to wait, or miso you have to wait 2-3 years, and people need to learn all about gaman and waiting for something to happen. But 29 years sounds pretty intense.
Right. Yeah. So you mentioned a couple different types of kombu, but you said Hidaka, I heard it, because it's softer, you can wrap, not just dashi,
right,
you know, you can wrap things. So that as you wrap the food, the kombu keeps releasing the flavor.
Yes.
So that's another benefit of using.
Right. Well, kombu is often used, kobu jime, is often used to sort of press ingredients between pieces of kombu, and it sort of gently releases those, the umami seibun, those glutamates, into it, and enhances the flavor of whatever is being pressed between it. Typically fish is done that way, but sometimes meat. And you can also do tofu.
Mm.
It works very well.
Mm. But as far as it's soaked, you can use other types of kombu for wrapping food, right? Because it's, as far as it's softened.
Nothing goes to waste in the Japanese kitchen. Right. And the kombu that you've used and taken that first extraction to make the intense dashi can always be repurposed and given a second life. Sometimes you need to cook it in order to do that. And so in cooking it and applying heat, you'll get a second dashi, a niban dashi.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll use that too. Right. But typically the kombu that is left after making stock is repurposed.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. Something like Hidaka kombu is easy to repurpose.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the others are a little bit more challenging.
Right. Okay. Mm-hmm. I can keep talking about kombu because I'm so passionate about this. But
we should probably let people know there are other things you can make dashi from. Or rather, the standard, I think for most Japanese, if you didn't specify, if you didn't go further and you just used the word dashi, they would imagine it's kombu and katsuobushi.
Mm, so let's talk about katsuobushi. That's dried bonito.
Right. It's, again, just amazing how people figured out this process to enhance, not only to preserve, because it probably, the initial reason for fiddling with it as much as they did was to help extend shelf life. But clearly in that process, they struck upon something that intensified the flavor potential enormously, and that was the main motivation for doing it. The very best katsuobushi is actually cured, and there's a good mold that is encouraged to be grown on the surface.
Right.
And so when you see it, it looks sort of like a dusty piece of... especially if it's cut through, it looks almost like mahogany wood, and if you hit it up against something, it sort of sounds like a wooden stick. It's hard to believe that it's really... food.
Right.
But the very best is the cured. And both kinds are available, and it's probably going to be very obvious from the price, because curing it is, again, labor intensive and requires more time. And
right. Well, before we get to the curing, so it's you know, the the bonito is caught right. and cut, and then remove the head and the guts and right. things like that, and cooked and remove bones.
Steamed, then, right. Yeah.
And then they are smoked.
Right.
And that's the... I think the key kind of flavor from bonito.
I call it the bacon of the sea because it really is like bacon. It's that very intense, smoky, rich flavor.
Right.
And in the process of processing the fish, and again, probably the Kyoto chefs went crazy over the different parts of the fillet and whether it was a belly piece or a back piece. And belly pieces tend to have a higher fat content and back pieces tend to be leaner. Mm. And depending upon, you know, the flavor you were looking for. The other is whether you're going to do chihai, there's a bloodline.
Mm.
And although it's a pleasantly funky flavor, I mean, it's nothing really offensive, the katsuobushi, where that has been removed first before it's been shaved into flakes, is different.
Right.
There's no doubt about it.
Mm. Yeah, I think I noticed if you go to Japanese grocery store, even in the United States, you can probably find different grades of bonito.
Yes.
It makes a big difference.
Huge. And the price really is a good indication. So in this case, spending a little bit more is probably worth it.
Mm. It's funny that one, we had a little party and there is no snack with the red wine.
Right.
And there's like a little thin cheese and the bonito sprinkled over it.
Oh.
That was perfect. Better than preparing something else.
Absolutely. Well, there's a sort of a dish, ohitashi, which means something's been steeped in dashi. And very often it gets finished with a few shavings or curls of the katsuobushi on top of it afterwards. And it's amazing the depth of flavor that can be imbued in these very bland foods.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, spinach never tasted better.
And I mean, grocery stores, there it's, you know, the shaped, already shaved, prepackaged version. But traditionally, there's a shaving, you know, little box.
I'm holding my thumbs so that I don't cut them.
Exactly.
I remember the terror of first trying to use one of those.
Right. It's kind of
boxes.
Like a mandarin and with the box underneath there's a drawer so that you can pull out and use
but
it.
But the blade is lethally sharp. And there are no sort of holders of the katsuobushi. You have to hold it in your hand. As far as I know, there's no safety latch available for these machines. I mean, it's now automated, but...
But oyster shack, you know,
I guess
the gloves.
So.
think of the metal
gloves. Right, on top of that. When I first went to Japan in the 60s, you would wake up in the morning to the sound of this scraping and sort of the smell of the katsuobushi because it really gets released as you would do that. Mm. Much like, I guess people rave over the smell of coffee beans being ground in the morning. In traditional Japan, it was the smell of katsuobushi being shaved.
Yeah, so it's dangerous, but it's worth shaving by yourself if you can.
If you can. And it's the angle. It's all about the angle and trying to find the right angle to get real long pieces.
Right.
But while we're on the subject of shaving, one of the reasons why there's something called atsu kezuri katsuobushi, also for sale, is nothing goes to waste in the Japanese kitchen, but fingers are more important than food.
Mm.
So people do have to stop before the entire piece has been shaved. And so you're left with these thicker chunks.
Mm.
Nothing should go to waste. They can also be used in making stocks and in sauces. So they will... You'll find them for sale in a separate bag, and they'll be thicker pieces. They'll be very obvious for what they are.
So it's almost like utilizing a Parmigiano rind kind of idea.
It's very much the same thing. And putting some of that in the bottom of a bottle of soy sauce or even vinegar will make it just incredibly wonderful.
Right, so
smoky
if you keep infusing.
Yes.
Wow, I have to try to get it next time my trip to Japan. Okay, so another important dashi ingredients, that's dried shiitake mushrooms.
Yes.
So what about it?
And especially if you are vegan or vegetarian and you don't want to consume animal products. It's a very woodsy flavor. And when dried shiitake come to market, they typically still have the stem attached and there are caps. So immediately I remove the stems and set them aside and keep the caps in a separate pile. Mm. If you're going to be cooking with the caps, there will be more than enough flavor of the mushrooms with just the caps alone. You don't need the stems. But truth be told, the concentration of mushroom flavor is greater in the stem than it is in the cap. So if you're making stocks, just a single, even dried shiitake stem will make all the difference in the world. Right.
Well, packaged ones tend to be only without stems and only the caps.
Really?
Yeah. Well, maybe I whatever I found recently in. Maybe not. Depending on which company.
Well, you'll see, and also if you can find broken bits and pieces. So typically, what I do is I will have two different canisters, one with the good caps that look pretty, that when I'm cooking and I want the vegetable to look good. Mm. And the other are broken bits and pieces and the stems. Mm. And typically the stem part is more concentrated in flavor.
Mm. I will have to keep it in mind. Okay. And it's not known so well, but it's called niboshi or iriko. That's another dried.
Right. It's in the sardine family, mm-hmm. and it tends to be, frankly, fishier in taste than the bonito.
It's very tiny, like, you know, even your pinky, small than pinky kind of fish, dried, it's shrunk. So it's very tiny, but very intense.
Very intense and very wonderful with certain foods. Mm. And in particular, if you're going to be... like for udon, down in Shikoku, in the Sanuki region, iriko, or niboshi, the two words for the same dried sardine, is the basis of the stock. And that's because the noodle that's cooked with it is wheat.
Mm.
And interestingly, if you're cooking soba, katsuobushi is a much better match.
Mm, interesting.
So most soba places will use katsuobushi in their broth and in their dip sauce. And most people in the sanuki, or those who are serving udon, will use iriko or niboshi.
Okay.
And you can try it for yourself. You can use standard stock when you're making udon. But then try it with a sardine, the iriko-based stock, and all of a sudden your noodles are going to taste better.
Interesting.
It's a very interesting sort of interaction between the
other.
So
the comparison between the soba, the buckwheat flavor and the wheat flavor, and also I think intensity, the udon is thicker, so maybe more intense niboshi or iriko flavor.
Well, but even somen, which is really very thread thin, is better, I think, with iriko.
So that's the wheat.
It's the wheat, I think, that works better with it.
Okay, so there are more ingredients for dashi, but let's move on to
okay.
Sorry. So what's the benefit of using dashi as a cook?
It wakes up the potential in almost anything. For food to taste its very best, you have to treat it well. You have to source good food to begin with, and it makes a big difference. But then you've gone to all this trouble to get the very best, and now you're wanting it to max out on its potential. Mm. And one way of doing that is to use dashi. And true of anything, I think, you're cooking, timing and temperature are two key factors. Mm. And sometimes you want low and slow, and sometimes you want fast and quick and high heat. And it all depends upon what you're making.
Right.
But being aware that there is a difference.
Mm. Okay. I think, first of all, there are other types of stock in other cuisines. But for instance, the bonito or the kombu, they're already prepared, spending months and months. So once it's in the kitchen, it takes, instead of 30, 40 minutes, It's just 5 minutes maximum.
Kombu
has to be soaked.
As long as you've soaked your kombu. If you're starting with kombu that's already been soaking at least 10, 15, 20 minutes.
Mm. You don't have to even cook if you soak.
It's 2 minutes. It's 2 minutes because you don't want that liquid to bubble. And although you can use fancy thermometers, and I've lived a Celsius life now for so long, it's hard for me to think in terms of Fahrenheit. But let's forget about numbers. What you're looking at in the pot is very simple.
Mm.
No matter how much water, how large your pot or small it is, and what sort of stove you've put it on, what you're looking for is bubble action.
Mm.
And as soon as you see small bubbles beginning come up the side and just beginning to break on the surface,
okay,
that's when you want to remove it from the heat.
Mm.
In Celsius,
right.
It's 70. Say 65 to 70.
Mm.
And you never want it to go over 80,
okay,
because that's going to draw out the bitter flavors, particularly of kombu. That's where you activate tannin.
Right.
And you're not wanting to draw that into the water. And below 65, so if you've got no bubbles coming up the side, you haven't given the umami sabun a chance to be released into the water.
Right.
So you want that magic sort of moment where the umami sabun has been released.
Right. Sabun means the umami elements.
The umami elements, right. And 80, 85, 90 is already much too high, is tannin being released. So you don't want it to get that high.
Right. So 70, 80 centigrade.
Yeah,
right.
Centigrade.
Sorry, I couldn't convert myself
I can't either. But just look for the bubble action because you don't really need a thermometer.
Sure.
And it's a much more accurate way of knowing. So I would say if you're not used to that, you've got a kitchen timer, set the timer for 2 minutes so that you don't get distracted.
Right.
And go back and look at the pot after 2 minutes. It's likely to be somewhere between 2 and 4 minutes that it will take for it to get, unless you're using a huge pot,
right,
that it'll take just for the bubbles to begin to break.
Mm.
And that's when you want to remove it from the heat. You want to add your katsuobushi.
Mm.
And then set the timer again for 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Longer, and you're going to draw out the fishiness.
Mm.
Less, and you don't get the good smokiness.
Right.
And then strain it out, and it's gorgeous.
Mm. So the bonito, at bonito, 2 minutes means only like, you know, they started to boil, like, and then 1 minute being boiled lightly, and you take it out?
No.
Kind of timing?
So you've removed it from the heat.
Uh-huh.
And it's no longer a source of heat, and you've added the katsuobushi.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it will sink, and sometimes it won't.
Mm.
And a lot of people say when it sinks, you strain it out. Not necessarily. It depends upon when you buy the bag.
Mm.
The top pieces are pieces are very big, and the bottom is very small and flaky.
Right.
And it's sort of like a parachute. The bigger the piece, the longer it takes to go down.
Right.
So if you've just opened the bag, it's likely to take longer for it to sink. But even so, even if it hasn't sunk after 2 or 3 minutes, you want to strain it out.
Mm. Okay.
And if you're using from the bottom of the bag, it might sink to the bottom right away, but you're not ready to take it out yet.
Mm.
You still need to give it about 2 minutes to release the good flavors into the liquid.
Optimal level.
Right.
Right.
Right. And both the katsuobushi and the kombu have secondary uses after you've made stock.
Mm. Okay.
Wonderful things to do with them.
Right. No wasting Japanese kitchen.
No.
Right. And the other thing, I think, whenever I have like this dashi element, like miso soup, if you have enough dashi, even if you screw up with amount of quantity of miso to add, you're good. It makes it so delicious.
It makes all the difference in the world.
Right. And I was at the Umami Forum organized by Ajinomoto Company. And I learned if you want to reduce consumption of salt, adding umami element, you can just equally 2 spoons of salt versus 1 spoon of salt and 1 spoon of umami element, then you can cut the salt percentage by 30%. So, and you're more satisfied. So I think it's the satisfaction is a very important part
there's,
of it.
Yes, I would describe, people often say, well, what does umami really mean? I'd say it's the potential of experiencing good flavor.
Mm.
and whether you're going to activate it or not. And using good dashi and being attentive to time and temperature,
right,
and you've got it done.
Okay. So you mentioned umami. Let's just quickly talk about umami. What is umami?
Well, I tend to think of it the way most Japanese do, and that is as a potential. It's not something that you add later. You don't add umami to a dish. You draw it out.
Right.
It's there, waiting to happen, and now it's up to you to draw it out and make it active.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, of course, umami is the savory taste after, you know, the sweet, salty, sour, bitter. But, yeah, so for the combination with dashi, you know, people say umami multiplies by adding different kinds of umami. So glutamic acid in kombu and vegetables and guanylic acid in and mushrooms or, you know, the bonito flakes that has inosinic acid. So these, I heard it can be 1 plus 1 could be 4, even 2.
I would say
15.
1 plus 1 is probably 100. it could, or think of it to the 10th power. There are certain combinations that release flavor and help you experience something as being more flavorful.
Right.
And being attentive to those, the different combinations, and you'll probably discover them for yourself as you're cooking. And even non-traditional Japanese ingredients like tomatoes, for example, you combine those with a good bonito, you know, katsuobushi dashi, and it's extraordinary.
Right. And again, it's the good thing is it's really easily available in Japanese grocery stores,
yes,
kombu
yes.
and bonito. And of course, if you want, you can get shiitake or the dried mushrooms too,
right.
anything you want. So, and
yes.
easy. Takes
yes.
short time. All right, so let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about how to make great dashi. So okay. please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japanese Broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Elizabeth Sando, a food writer and a cookbook author and a Japanese cooking instructor based in Tokyo. So one thing you mentioned earlier, you know, the ichiban dashi, niban dashi. So what are they? Just basically quickly go through.
Well, ichiban dashi is the very first extraction, and niban would be the second. And there's some, not loss of flavor, there's what you've already extracted, but there's still flavor left, and it would be mottainai, or true waste of the ingredient, if you didn't help encourage out that secondary flavor.
Mm.
So I call it a secondary stock, and sometimes it's actually a better choice when you're not wanting it to fight with very definitively flavored foods. So if you have a very strong flavored food, you might actually want the more gentle flavor of a secondary stock instead of the primary one, which would be very smoky and very sea-like.
Right. So you want to keep the dashi as a background. You want to have the secondary
right.
dashi. Right. So no waste in Japanese kitchen.
Absolutely not.
All right. So let's talk about how to make good dashi. So maybe you can talk about the basic recipes.
Okay. And also, before I came here today, I switched over my website. Mm. And if people go to tasteofculture.com and click on Kitchen Culture, they'll find a whole page about dashi and three different sets of recipes that they can download.
Wonderful. Yeah. Okay.
It'll be up there for about a week, mm-hmm. and then it'll be switched over to something else, but come back and see what something else is afterwards.
Okay, sure. Great. So,
just sort of walking people through, the single most important thing, almost every stock in the Japanese kitchen is going to start with kombu. Mm. So you're going to get yourself some kelp, and if you're able to pair the right variety with the water that you have, you'll get even better results. Mm. But any kombu will work with any water.
Right. Okay.
So you're going to start with a piece of kombu. There are some people who will tell you to wipe it and other people who don't. People who will tell you to snip into it and other people who don't. The white stuff that may or may not be on there is the good umami seibun. You don't want to wipe that off.
Right.
The likelihood that you're going to have trapped a piece of sand or a pebble when it was drying on the beach, you can strain it out afterwards. I don't think there's anything to be gained from wiping the kombu. Mm-hmm. I would just put it in the water and let it soak. Certain varieties of kombu are going to be more wrinkled, so that it's more likely stuff might get caught in those wrinkles, and others are going to be flatter, so there's not going to be anything caught there. But so you're going to start with some kombu, and you're going to gently, this is where the slow and low method really works better, gently over low heat, start to heat that water.
Mm.
And when you see little bubbles beginning to break on the surface, you're going to remove the pot from the heat, particularly if you've got an electric range where you can't quickly change to lower heat. And add whatever other ingredient, like your katsuobushi flakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we took that earlier.
And then strain it out in just a few minutes afterwards. The other thing is, if you're going to, of course, using dashi right away is wonderful, but making some and keeping it in the fridge is always a nice idea. You've got that potential there. It can be heated back up again, or it could be used cold.
Mm.
And if you're going to be doing that, to make sure that you don't cover, in other words, let whatever steam escape is going to escape from the hot broth before you put it in a glass jar to put in the refrigerator, because otherwise the condensation is going to water down the flavor.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So basically, kombu, you should soak it.
Right.
Overnight or half an hour at least.
Right.
And then you have to watch. Just cook it. Wait for the bubbles come up.
Right.
And then if you want to add bonito.
Right. So until your body learns this new rhythm, you might want to set a timer or make sure that you're not going to get distracted with a lot of other things.
Mm.
But otherwise, it's probably, I think the Japanese home kitchen is naturally inclined to multitask. Nothing takes particularly long, and lots of things can be happening at the same time.
Mm.
And making dashi is definitely something that can happen on the back burner.
Right.
As long as you're aware that you shouldn't be letting it go for too terribly long.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So how do you use dashi? You can give us some examples of what kind of dishes.
Well, probably the simplest is in simmered and in soups.
Mm.
And depending upon the kind of soup or what you're simmering, the amount you're going to use and when you're going to add it is going to be different.
Mm-hmm.
But dashi can be used for a long simmer, maybe 30, 40 minutes, even longer, and it won't go bitter if it was properly made. But it also can be used for a very quick making of miso soup, for example.
Mm.
It doesn't, all of the flavor potential is there already in the dashi. So it doesn't matter whether it's used for long-term cooking or short-term cooking.
Right.
It's also a great ingredient to use to combine with other things that are very intense to cut the intensity so it's not sort of cloying and overwhelming. But you're not losing flavor. You're not watering it down. The difference between cutting with dashi and cutting with water is huge.
Right. So, for instance, you know, even like all the miso soup, if you have miso soup without dashi, just miso, it doesn't taste anything good at all.
No.
And, of course, ramen chefs really put emphasis on making the great dashi because that's their life. Right. And, of course, udon. Well, anything. I mean, basically, it's hard to find Japanese dishes without dashi, in a way. Even like omelette.
Yes. Well, very definitely with egg, it makes a huge difference. Mm. And that's where you need it cooled down so that it's not going to start cooking the eggs ahead of time.
Right. So basically, you know, stronger the flavor, like bonito tend to be very strong, like smoky. Right. So you can have the dipping sauce of noodles or depending on the ingredients in it. So that's the thing. Kombu is more delicate.
Very definitely, kombu is a more delicate stock, and there are other dried vegetables that are used. And if people go to my website and they download, you'll see that there's one whole series of instructions about using, they're all vegan stocks, different kinds of dried vegetables. And each of them, just like I would describe katsuo bonito as having a bacon-like smoky flavor, dried radish has a certain kind of flavor, dried gourd kampyo has a different kind of flavor. So each of these have other sorts of subtle accents that they can add to things. And there are probably certain combinations that are going to be more successful than others, but that's also, I think, the fun for people to sort of play around with it and decide for themselves what the best match is.
So it's interesting, you kind of summarize that the concept of Japanese dashi is based on dried ingredients.
Yes.
And it really reduces time for you to spend in the kitchen. So it's convenient and with much more concentrated flavor naturally.
Yeah, and I don't really understand people who use so-called instant dashi, because I'm not sure that you're saving any time.
Right, and you get so many other chemicals that you don't want to have.
For most of them, unfortunately, yes. Right. There are a lot of other chemicals involved.
Right. Yeah, one thing I really like, you know, I make dashi and then put it in the rice cooker with just rice, plain rice. And it changes the whole thing. Of course, you can add more ingredients, but that's like a Japanese restaurant.
Yes, or even just if you take your kombu water and use that instead of regular water when you're cooking your rice. When I make sushi rice, I always do that. And it makes a huge difference. Right. Huge difference. So I cook my rice for making sushi with kombu jiru rather than water.
Okay. Wow. So usually sushi places only have salt, sugar, water, and vinegar. But do you have adashi? I mean,
But when they're cooking the rice, they probably add a piece of kombu either to the pot or like I do, they use the liquid instead.
Right. And so how long can you say, I'm lazy. Right. So if I want to have, you know, dashi regularly and cooking, say, a like whole pot, how long does it last in the fridge?
It depends. Probably, I would say 3 days is a very safe number. 5 is probably okay. What you need to know is what to look for signs of spoilage. And a sediment at the bottom is not what you're looking for. So depending upon whether it was the bottom of the bag of katsuobushi and whether your cheesecloth did or did not have a fine weave, you could get a lot of sediment and it's still not spoiled. So that's not a good sign. Smell is probably the best. And interestingly, the first sign that it's going off is a sweet smell rather than sour or ammonia-like, because the chemical decomposition first releases a sweeter smell. So if it smells suddenly very sweet, it's suspicious, and you probably would want to boil and strain it And use it. It's not going to be as wonderful as it could be, but you don't necessarily have to throw it out. If you see what I call somebody forgot to check the pockets before they did the laundry, and you see those sort of white, you know, the tissue that was left in the pocket. If you see things like that floating in there, it's definitely off, and you probably should toss it.
Right. So I would say 3 days is being
3 days is safe. Right. Yeah, three days is safe.
So I can do every 3 day cooking of dashi. So
yeah, easily.
Right. So that's the point. Easily.
Easily.
Right. So okay. So for listeners, can you repeat again where they can find the recipes?
Tasteofculture.com. www.tasteofculture.com. And if you click on my kitchen culture link, you'll see right now you'll see a whole thing about stocks and dashi, and every. There's no regular schedule. About every week or 10 days, I shift over to new and different things.
Okay. Is there any archive, too?
Unfortunately, I'm having trouble with my archives, and so it's hard for people to access things that are in the archives. Okay. I'm trying to get that fixed, but I can't tell you when it's going
to
happen.
So, listeners, if you happen to listen to this episode after the website is gone, then web page is gone, then please... contact us and I can just find it, the copy, PDF.
I'll give you the... Once it goes off and it goes into the archive, it gets a different designation and I can give that to you.
Great. Yeah. All right. So, so thank you for joining us
again. Thank you for such a great, wonderful opportunity.
So I cannot wait for the next one, number 7.
Likewise. But,
all right. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics for the show, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japanese is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And our engineer today is Matt Patterson, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.